I think I have a little advantage over all of you. You look just beautiful this morning. I should have said that first. You look just beautiful this morning, and the reason I can say that is that I have this advantage over you. You see, Saturday morning, when the convention began, they asked me to lead the singing. So I was up here, you know, and I was watching all of you, and you were all looking a little worried. You just arrived at the convention. Maybe you've been driving for hours and hours, and you wonder, well, I wonder if I shut off the stove. I wonder if they took the coffee pot off the top of the burner, and I wonder if I turned the thermostat down. All these worries were on your faces. But by the time Saturday night rolled around and Sunday afternoon rolled around, you were looking a lot better. And today you just look beautiful. You've forgotten all about your worries. You were rejoicing in the Lord together, and it's just wonderful to be here together and be released from all those cares and worries and concerns. We leave it to the Lord. Whatever's back there is back there. So you just look beautiful today. I'm an old Waterbury class, you know, member. Somebody told me I forgot to mention that yesterday, and so I thought I'd better correct it. We've enjoyed our fellowship there for many, many years, and of course, seeing many of you has brought back a lot of memories to me. There was a Greek brother there. You know, I've heard a lot of good speakers in my time in attending meetings and so on, yet the one individual that I look back upon in my Christian walk that really helped me to appreciate the truth was a Greek brother in Waterbury named Brother Cedar. And in his halting, stumbling English, he did it. It doesn't take, you know, an orator or a great speaker to help us to appreciate the truth. His sincerity and love for the Lord and the truth made me think that there must be something that I'm missing. And I'm glad I found it. I used to call Brother Woodworth Brother Woolworth. He thought he owned that all those 5 and 10 cent stores, you know. But he was just a wonderful brother, and I look down here and I see Sister Slutovsky and Sister Strohanyets. Brings back memories. My parents used to go to meeting with them in New Haven. You see Sister Wanda here. Boy, we go way back. I mean, I was this tall when she was a little taller. She's much older than I am. She was a neighbor of mine. She and her father and mother, and we grew up in Merchantville, New Jersey. Nice to see Wanda again. And you know, I could just stop and never get to my list if I talked about everybody that I know here and that I love so dearly. But it's nice to see us all together rejoicing in the Lord. Well, pride is something that God hates. And I just like to... There are many texts of scriptures that talk about pride. I'm going to read two of them only. One from Proverbs 16, verse 18. It says, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. One in James, the 4th chapter, I think it's the 6th verse, says, God resisteth the proud, resists the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. God doesn't like people who have too much pride. So our lesson today is on pride, really. I think as a group, Bible students are very romantic people. Now, you may not have thought of yourself as being very romantic, but we are. We like stories with a happy ending, and that's what we found here in the Bible. We found a story with a happy ending. And maybe because of that, we have thought that Adam disobeyed God's law because he was so afraid of losing Eve. And that may have entered the mind of Adam, that he just couldn't bear the thought of being alone again. And he just felt that as long as she had eaten of that apple, it was an apple. And if it was an apple, it was a Washington Delicious apple, by the way. If she ate of it, he thought he should do it too. He wanted to be with her. Wherever she was going to be going, he wanted to be with her. And that's the love that God planted in the heart of man for woman and the heart of woman for man. And that, I'm sure, entered the picture. But I think there's something else that entered the picture too. And that was, of course, the devil and his appeal to Adam, and pride entered into the heart of Adam and said, I deserve more than I'm getting. You know, as you read the account in Genesis, the third chapter, there's really nothing there that says that Adam was afraid of losing Eve. Here's what it says. It says, now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. You're not even supposed to touch the tree. I didn't know that. I think that, I don't know if that was added by Eve or what, but there's no record that God ever said it. But she said, don't even touch it. Maybe Adam told her, you know, don't even touch the tree. And the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes are going to be opened. Here comes the appeal. And ye shall be as gods, mighty ones, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and here's another appeal, and a tree to be desired to make one wise. Everybody wants to be wise, don't they? Why, she took the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. See, Satan appealed to that desire to be something more than perhaps God had allowed them to be. Appealed to their pride. Now, in addition to the fact that that's the way I feel about it, I think we have a very interesting account of a picture in Daniel, the fourth chapter. And actually, we're going to have quite a little study on Daniel, the fourth chapter this morning. And I think this helps to corroborate that thought, that pride did enter into the heart of Adam, and that just kind of tilted the scales enough to cause him to disobey God. And this involves, you remember, a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. We're going to read a little bit from chapter 4, beginning with verse 5 and 6, and then we're going to skip to verse 10. It said, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. And we're going to skip to verse 10. It says, thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. And the tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much. And in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, And behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit, and let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls which from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. And let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. That is quite a dream. First you see this great big tree, and then a messenger comes down and says, cut the tree down. That's kind of interesting to me, because just recently I've been working on this retirement center project. Now, you knew I was going to mention something about that. But we've been having to knock down a lot of trees. And the man that we've hired to do that, he doesn't cut the tree down. Now, we had several trees that, you know, we were inexperienced, and so we thought they're in the way, so we ought to cut them down. And we did. We used a chainsaw and just cut the tree down as near the stump as we could, the roots, and left the stump in the ground. Then we thought, well, we'll just dig the stump out of the ground. But this man that we hired said, that's not the way to get rid of trees. If you want them out of there, he says, all you do is push them over, and then as you push them over, the weight of the tree pulls the stump out, then you don't have to go to all that work of digging the stump out. And you know, it works. But and we've cut down a lot of trees. We hated to do that, but they were in the way of the buildings. But here God says, cut the tree down and leave the stump alone. And that's kind of meaningful, I think, in this whole picture that God is drawing for us. And then, of course, Nebuchadnezzar gets so worried about what does this dream mean? He tries the wise men, and they don't help him at all. And so he finally goes to Daniel, and Daniel interprets the vision. And we're going to read his explanation of that. Go on into the 19th verse. Let's see, he just repeats what the king said. And we'll start with the 22nd verse. He says, it is thou, O king, that art grown strong. He's referring to the tree. Now, it is thou, O king, that art grown strong, grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High which has come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heavens, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Well, that was quite an interpretation of the dream. And we have often wondered about this dream, what it represents. Now, we have another dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. You remember it involves an image in Daniel, the second chapter. And you're all familiar with that. I'm not going to read that. But you'll recall that there again, Daniel interprets the vision. And if I told you, for instance, that I thought that the vision of Daniel, the second chapter, represented the head of gold would represent the Catholic Church, and then the rest of the body would represent all the other various denominations that grew out of that Catholic Church system with all of the errors that they have, you'd say, no, that's wrong. And why would you say that? Well, you'd say that because Daniel gave us the interpretation of that vision. He says, the head of gold represented Nebuchadnezzar, And then the other parts of the body represent the various kingdoms that would come up after Nebuchadnezzar. So when we have this vision of Daniel, the fourth chapter, with this tree that's cut down and yet the stump is left, and then the picture changes to that of a man who becomes as a beast, we don't have to worry about what that tree represents or what that beastly looking man who had seven times passed over him represents. Daniel tells us. And so we know what the tree and the beastly man represents. It represents something that was going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar. But Brother Russell suggests that Nebuchadnezzar could very well represent Adam. And I often wondered why, because I could find really no explanation as to how Brother Russell came to that conclusion. And so I just have a couple of suggestions, and one of them is something that's mentioned to Jeremiah, that Jeremiah, the 27th chapter, verses 5 and 6, where Jeremiah, speaking for God, says this about Nebuchadnezzar. He says, I have made the earth, the man and the beast that are upon the ground by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and have given it unto whom it seemed meet unto me. God says, I'm the one who puts these leaders in the position of authority. And last night there was a presidential debate on the TV, and we have an election coming up, and I can predict who's going to be the next president. And my prediction is that it's going to be the person that God wants in there, just as he placed Nebuchadnezzar in the position of authority, because that's the man he wanted there. So whoever is going to be the next president is going to be the man that God wants in there. We think we are electing him, you know. But anyway, going on with this account, it says, now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And this is the significant part of this text. And the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve him. Now keep that thought in mind, all right? Now we're going to go to Daniel, the second chapter, and verses 37 and 38. We're going to read something very similar to what we read in Jeremiah. And it says, and this is Daniel, of course, interpreting the dream about the image. And he says, there thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And here again is that significant part that we want to call to your attention. It says, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. Now the reason we say this is very significant is that as far as we know, as far as I know anyway, God has never said that about any other individual other than Adam and Nebuchadnezzar. As far as we know, there's no record of God ever saying to any other individual that the beasts of the field and the fowl of the air would be under their rule. Now, we've inherited that, we say, that rulership over the beasts of the field and so on. But God says, in this case, I've given it to Adam, and now I give it to Nebuchadnezzar. And so perhaps that's the reason Brother Russell suggests that Nebuchadnezzar represents Adam. I don't know. Maybe if I'm faithful and see Brother Russell, maybe I might ask him that question if I think of it. But that seems to me at least one line of thought that might indicate that we're on the right track, thinking that Nebuchadnezzar does represent Adam. All right, we're going to get to this vision and what it represents. I think in the fourth chapter, verse 27, where it says, where Daniel goes on. Now, this worries Daniel, this interpretation of the vision, because, of course, Nebuchadnezzar has been very good to him, placed him in a leadership role and in authority. And he says, you know, if only you'd listen to me. I want you to listen to what I say, and maybe you can avoid what's going to happen. But he puts it this way. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee. Break off thy sins by righteousness, in thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. I think this pictures a time when God told Adam, if you obey, you'll live. If you disobey, you're going to die. He says something very similar to that in Daniel, the second chapter also, but we're not going to take time to read that. But anyway, we go on. Verse 28, we find it says, all this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesties? Look what I've done. He let pride enter his heart and thought, well, you know, I'm really quite a king. A lot of people obey me. I have a lot of power and strength, big armies to fight my wars for me. And he thought he was really something. I think that could very well represent the period of time when Adam was in the Garden of Eden. He was the complete ruler of the garden, named all the animals and so on, and had no one to question his authority. Had a relationship with God that must have been wonderful. And so here Nebuchadnezzar accomplishes much. And we read that the city of Babylon was one of the seven wonders of the world. It was so beautiful. And yet today, there's nothing left there but dry weeds and sand. And there's a little sign as a train goes by the station that used to be for the city of Babylon. And even the sign that says, standing on an angle, it's crooked, nobody's paying any attention to it anymore. And that fulfills prophecy, as we know that God said that that would happen to Babylon because it was such a wicked city. But anyway, here Nebuchadnezzar has this 12-month period, though, you notice. He has 12 months in which to enjoy what he's doing after he sees this vision. Now, I don't know. You have to help me here. I don't know what this 12 months represents, except it represents the period of time that Adam was in the garden and before pride entered into his heart. And he expressed that pride by disobeying God. I don't know how 12 months fits it. We know he was in the garden more than 1 year. The least that he was there was 2. And some will say he was in there 100 years, you know. And we really have no text of Scripture that tells us how long Adam was in the Garden of Eden. So if you can give me a formula that says 12 months equals so many years, that would be wonderful, on a scriptural basis, of course. So anyway, this is what we think that period of time of 12 months represents. And then we read verse 31. What happens? While the word was in the king's mouth, just like that, it says, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. Kingdom was removed from Nebuchadnezzar. And I think that pictures the time when Adam disobeyed God, partook of the fruit of the forbidden tree, and he was evicted from the Garden of Eden. Now we go on to verse 32. It says, they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and 7 times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Now, we'll read one more. The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. Long hair, fingernails with long claws on them, 7 times passed over this king, who had enjoyed the benefits of a palace, servants, and others to wait on him and give him whatever he pleased. He was driven away from all that luxury and comfort. Of course, that represents a time that man has been away from God. Now, this is kind of interesting especially when we compare that condition that's described about Nebuchadnezzar with a text in the Ecclesiastes, the 3rd chapter, verse 19. There we read that that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. There's a similar text to that in Psalms, the 49th chapter, verse 12. It says, nevertheless, man being in honor abideth not. He is like the beasts that perish. Now you see, the reason that's so significant is that at one time man did have a preeminence above a beast. As far as we know, God never promised life everlasting to the animals in the Garden of Eden, as long as they were obedient to his laws. But he did promise that to man. Man was way up here. You remember the chart of the ages? Man was way up here on this plateau. The beasts had no such promises. He was way above a beast. But then because of his disobedience, he fell. And now the wise man in Ecclesiastes says, man has no preeminence above a beast. And in the text in Psalms, he said, he had honor at one time. Now he's no different than a beast. So we see how this pictures the condition of Adam before he fell, and then his condition after he fell. As far as God is concerned, he's like a beast. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar's experience pictures, the experience of Adam and all of mankind during this long period of time since Adam disobeyed God. Now, how long is it going to last? Well, in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, it was seven times. Now, I think that represents the 7,000 years. Now, somebody's going to be real smart in the audience and say, I got you. Mankind isn't like a beast for 7,000 years. He's there only there for 6,000 years. And I've got an answer for that. In reality, I think the argument has a lot of merit. Except that mankind, still for that other 1,000-year period, is still estranged from God. He has no relationship with God except through the mediator, Christ and the church. So as far as God is concerned, man is still way down here like a beast and subject to death if he does not turn away from unrighteousness during that mediatorial reign of Christ and the church. And so, from God's standpoint, man is still down on that lower level. You know, we talked about that upper concourse up here where we eat dinner. Well, we're still down on the lower concourse and subject to death, just like a beast. And man's going to stay there unless he learns what lesson. Well, we'll go on and read now what lesson man has to learn. And at the end of the days, says, this is verse 34, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me. Finally got through to Nebuchadnezzar what he should have been thinking, rather than thinking what a great person he personally was. But Daniel had told him that God had set him over the kingdom. He said, you have no right to take any credit to yourself. It was God that set you up over the kingdom. He says, lifted up mine eyes and mine understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. Finally, Nebuchadnezzar realizes what a fool he had been. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? Well, one man dared to ask God that question. You remember, it was Job. He says, what are you doing to me? I've tried to live a righteous life. I love you and worship you. Why are you doing this to me? You know what God told him? He said, you don't have the right to ask that question. You read it in Job, I think it's about the 37th or 38th chapter. And here, Nebuchadnezzar says the same thing. He says, I finally recognize that I have no right to ask God. And nobody has the right to ask God, why are you doing this? All we have to know is that God knows best and that whatever is being done is for man's best eternal welfare. And then he says, at that same time, my reason returned unto me. And for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me. And my counselors and my lords sought unto me. And I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Here we have mankind, a picture of mankind and their return to God and a relationship with God. And I have counselors, ancient worthies. I have honor. I've got life more abundant than mankind ever had it before. And it says, excellent majesty was added unto me. Now, what would that mean? Well, I think in the case of mankind, at one time they were perfect. So how can you be more than perfect in the kingdom? Well, you can be more perfect in this way. We've had the experience with sin and death and what comes as a result of disobeying God. That's the excellent majesty that was added to mankind's perfection that they did not have in the kingdom. And then Nebuchadnezzar says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment. And then he adds, and those who walk in pride, he is able to abase. Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, the whole experience has been because I got to feeling that I was somebody. That I was really somebody. And instead he says, I realize I'm nobody without God. And so if the picture is right, if Nebuchadnezzar represents Adam, Adam had to learn the lesson of pride before he could come back into a relationship with God. And that's why I say pride was at least a part of Adam's downfall. Now, you don't have to agree with me that's so. That's not the important thing. The important thing that we do have to agree on, and I know we do agree on, is that man at one time did have honor and majesty and was above a beast. He fell, but he's going to be restored to that same position that he had in the Garden of Eden. That we do agree on. And what a comfort and a joy it is to have that knowledge now ahead of the world of mankind. There's one last thought that I want to mention, and that is that we as members of the church have to get rid of pride now. Now, we have to. The world of mankind will have 1,000 years or whatever portion of it they're going to have after they've been raised from the dead. We have our lifetime condensed to less than 70 years, which is, I guess, the average lifespan of most people that are living today. Some live to be 80 or 90, and those latter years become very difficult for them. But we have to condense 1,000 years of experience and learning into 50 years, probably, or 40 or 30, depending on how much more time is left. According to Brother George, we have 10 more years left. to make our calling election sure. And that may be right. We should live as if tomorrow is the day that the Lord's going to call us home. And I'm reminded of Jesus' words to the disciples, and he gave them this parable about the man who had so much grain to harvest that he thought, well, I've got so much, I'm going to store it all away for a rainy day, and I've got to build some more barns. So there he goes, building some more barns, and you know what the Lord said to him? Thou fool. He said, thou fool, this night thy soul is required of thee. He said, you're building barns, and he says, you're going to die tonight. Tonight could be bad for us, too. Who knows? Going home, we hope you'll all be careful and drive carefully. But an accident could take us home. And so the lesson for us is, just as the world of mankind must lose that thing that God hates so much, pride, that's what we have to get rid of also. And I think pride is in back of most of the problem. Now, Brother Ken Rawson spoke quite eloquently last night about the need for us to work together a little more closely as body members. I love that thought. I think it's wonderful, and I think we should, and we're doing that in this convention. But most of the problems, I think, are the root of them is pride. Pride in our own thoughts and our own way of doing things, thinking that that's the only way that can be done. So, brethren, let's try to get the lesson that we must eliminate pride from our hearts in order to be pleasing to God. I read a little story about a little girl who was praying to God at the close of the day. She'd had a wonderful time playing with her playmates, and her prayer when she went to bed that night was, she thanked God for all the good times she had that day. And then just as an afterthought, she says, I hope you had a good time too. But you know, every night, when we go to bed, that's a good thought to keep in mind. Thank the Lord for the day and the blessings of the day. And then say to God, I hope that what I have done has brought you some pleasure. Wouldn't it be nice for God to say, I did have a good time, thanks to David Bruce, or whoever it might be. As a result of our actions, let's bring joy to our Heavenly Father. And I know our gathering together in convention in this way has brought pleasure to God. And I can see God up there looking down on us, and he's saying, oh, look, there are my children all gathered together. They're down there, and they're talking about me. God add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother David. We have the hymn that says, I know not await me, God kindly veils my eyes. It's a good thing sometimes that we can't see what awaits us. God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform, and he certainly knows what is best for us.